You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
LA Sun, my life, my city, my food, is a chance to ride shotgun with Roy Choi. This memoir and recipe book is Choi's Wild West. The narrative takes you on an odyssey through our state, from the early days of his family's culinary outings, when they trekked up to Santa Barbara for abalone, or to Indio for bean sprouts for his mom's bibimbap, to the first time eating a banh mi in the OC. Food has colored Choi's world from the moment he entered it, and LA Sun blends these stories with the rhythm of his bad boy street slang, keeping things picante, just like the salsa roja of LA's most flavorful taco from the famous Kogi BBQ truck. When I first learned of the title of the book, I thought he had called it LA Son, Son, the rhythm, the backbone of Latin music, the one you hear driving down Whittier Boulevard or cruising through MacArthur Park. It's that rhythm and soul that he puts into his food and everything he does, and the beat keeps up on the page. Choi-isms are sprinkled throughout like little pieces of advice next to his recipes. Drink, burp, smile. Choi's voice is practically in your ear. We experience the complete journey from growing up in an immigrant family with memories of chili spaghetti at Bob's Big Boy, to the poor choices he made along the way and the family that put him back on his feet. But all throughout, there's a relentless spirit and a determination to find rhythm that really sets him free. Roy Choi is a trailblazer who has revolutionized the way we think about food and the way we move with it. His Kogi BBQ truck has forever changed the landscape of this city. Classically trained with experience in the kitchens of Le Bernardin, the Embassy Suites, and the Beverly Hilton, Choi now has his name on Chinatown's Chego and Westside Restaurant's A-Frame and Sunny Spot, and soon to be opening Pot. Choi shares the author credit with Tin Nguyen, senior food writer for the LA Weekly, and Natasha Fan, business development manager for Choi's Restaurants and winner of Zagat's 30 Under 30 Award, distinguishing her for her contribution to the food industry. And moderating tonight's conversation, we are honored to have Evan Kleiman with us, culinary tastemaker, pie lover, and the voice of KCRW's 15-year and running fabulous show, Good Food. Kleiman generously shares her spirit and passion for food with our city in her speaking work and through participation on the LA Food Policy Council and in statewide organization called Roots of Change. I hope you had the pleasure of tasting her culinary deliciousness at Angeli Cafe on Melrose during its 27-year run. Kleiman is also an author with 6 books to her name and the creator of an Easy as Pie app for your iPhone. Last year, Choi marveled at our menu collection when we hosted him on this same stage, and tonight we're thrilled to welcome him back. You've already heard the buzz on NPR and in the papers, but tonight marks his first live stop to celebrate LA Sun with the City of LA, and we thank him for choosing the LA Public Library. Please welcome to the Aloud stage Roy Choi and Evan Kleiman.
Hello, you. Yeah, it feels good to be home. Feels so good to be home.
It's really nice to be here. I feel like I've gotten to know Roy over the last year. And when you get to know somebody and you spend some time together and then they hand you a book, you really want that book to be good.
If it sucked, what would happen to our relationship?
Oh my God, it would be awful.
We'd pass each other and say hi.
And I have... And it was that experience where I had the galleys, and they were sitting there, and the time for him to come to KCRW to be interviewed for the show was getting closer and closer. I'm like, I have to open this book. And so from the minute I opened it until I finished it, that's all I did. It became one of those, don't bug me, I'm reading, sort of situation, where you go out in the world and you do what you have to do, but in your mind, you're sort of enveloped in this world that's been created by somebody else. So it's really meaningful for me, being an LA daughter, that that he wrote this book for a lot of reasons. I think that the way people think of chefs these days, as gods even, it, you know, everybody comes from a place, and flavor doesn't just come from food. Flavor comes from experience and belief, and Roy's put all of that into the book. So let's start.
Okay, I'm ready.
You're ready.
I'm ready.
Were you born in the States?
No, I was born in Seoul, Korea. I was born in a section called Jongno. Korea, Seoul is split by the Han River, and y'all heard that song, Gangnam Style, right? Well, like... Gangnam didn't exist. Gangnam means south of the river. That didn't exist. Seoul was a very small town, and then the center of the city was called Jongno, and I was born in a hospital there. But I was born with a cleft disorder, so it was kind of like dramatic, you know, like in Korea, the medicine wasn't fully evolved, you know, as far as like the equipment and the whole processes and everything, and I came out with this cleft. To be honest, I don't even know if they knew what to do with me. Like, it was, I always imagine like the doctor's room, like, comes out, ah! Like, what the fuck do we do with this dude? You know, and then like, but yeah, I was born in Seoul. And then I came here when I was 2.
And part of that was your parents wanted to protect you from maybe discrimination.
I think so. I think it was partly them as well, too. They had already been in America. My dad came over in 63, pretty early, and he studied East Coast and came West. My mom came in a couple years later, but they got married. They met here in L.A. They got married off of Vermont and Jefferson, they stayed up in the crib up in on Crenshaw. And they were here, man. They were here in the 60s in L.A., and then they went back. I don't know why.
Why did they go back?
I don't know. I have no idea. Maybe it has something to do with their visa. I have no idea. I think partly had to do maybe with, you know, Korea is a Confucian state country, and so it's like you're always burdened with like having to go back and like, you know, make things right, you know, and like always listen to your elders and all that stuff. So I think they went back, but once you taste America, it's hard to go back.
Yeah, it's really hard.
It's really, really hard. Any immigrant can tell you that, you know.
So what did your parents do when they were there when they came the first time? Give us a little snapshot of their lives.
When they came the first time?
Yeah.
My dad came as a student. He was an extremely smart man. He was, if you have to imagine, in 63, they weren't letting Asians into this country. It's really hard to imagine, right? But there was an Immigration Act passed in 65. So before 65, most of the Asians that were coming in this era had to be on education grants. So He was top of his class, you know, and he went out to UPenn on a grant. And he was going to become a diplomat, and then he eventually made it west. He finished at UPenn, went to Boulder, and then came out to UCLA during Kareem's time, Lou Alcindor's time. He always tells me the story that he was in the elevator with Lou Alcindor, and he asked him to press the button. That's his that's like his story, you know. Like it's always, I've been hearing that fucking story since like I was 4. But yeah, he came out here first. My mom came out here for art school, and I think she went to not Pasadena, but California art school, and then Institute of the Arts or whatever it is. Cal Arts, yeah. She went out.
Just
came
a little
out here
school.
Yeah, just a little. She came out here for that, and then they met, and I think they started partying, man. They were only in their mid-20s, you know, like probably late, mid to late 20s. So, you know, I always try to break down, like, memory and folklore into reality. And then so, like, if I think of it in a romantic stage, you know, like, you know, they went to college, they did all these things, but I think of them as, like, 20-year-olds. They probably, like, were partying and got down and did that thing. And, like, they ended up dropping out of school, and then they got married, and they moved back to Korea.
Then they felt guilty and went back.
They felt guilty and went back, and they had me. I had this disorder, and that part I didn't ask, but, like, I think Korea is a very homogeneous country, so I think that was part of the decision as well. Like, you can't really, like, succeed if even your hair is parted the wrong, right, you know, wrong way. So.
It's parted very beautifully tonight.
Thank you.
So they come back. Mm-hmm. They have you with them. Where do you land?
We landed right here, K-Town, Olympic and Vermont. We lived in an apartment on Westmoreland, so right off Olympic. And my dad had a liquor store on Vermont and where James Woods is right now, which used to be 9th Street. And, yeah, we landed right there.
And what was Koreatown like then?
It wasn't Koreatown. it was a bunch of Koreans in Los Angeles, but it wasn't Koreatown. It wasn't Koreatown. There was only one market at the time. This was 1973, maybe 72. But there was only one market. It's on Harvard and Olympic, or Hobart and Olympic, Harvard and Olympic, right there. It's right now. It's currently a Western Union. And then there was few restaurants, very few. There was Dongiljang on 8th Street, and there were a few mom and pop restaurants here and there. But we had to create kind of our own cuisine at the time. You know, like we didn't have all these ingredients. You couldn't like just go to the market and find all these ingredients. So, you know, we used to make makeshift kimchis with, we'd buy sauerkraut at the market, and then we'd take chili powder and then Tabasco sauce, and then garlic, and we'd crush the garlic, and then put chili powder in there, bunch of Tabasco sauce, you know, and then vinegar, and then mix that all up, and then mix that into the sauerkraut, and then that would become kimchi. You know? Yeah, crazy.
When did things start to transform?
I would say probably very quickly. I would say probably 75, 76, 78, around there is where things started to transition. A lot more Koreans started coming in. Real estate was really cheap in K-Town at that time. So I write about it in the book a little bit, but you know, this area that is Koreatown now used to be Old Hollywood, right? Many of you probably know that. You know, Brown Derby, and you know, you had the Ambassador Hotel. You had, you know, this was the stretch of Wilshire Boulevard where you know, Lucille Ball hung out, you know. But by the 70s, everything moved west, and the place was dirt cheap, you know. So, yeah, I mean, what was the question again?
It's okay. You did. So you're like 3 to 5.
Yeah. And oh, in Koreatown. Yeah, so it started developing around that time. Okay, I was 3 to 5.
And your parents now are doing what for a living?
Well, liquor store ended by the time we were like 5 or 6. Then they got into the jewelry business. But they got into jewelry business twice in their life. But this time, this was mid-70s. So it was agate, turquoise.
Hippie jewels.
Hippie jewelry, yeah. Big old things and big old pendants like this with gold. And they did fish fossils. Their big thing was fish fossils. So we would get trilobites. It's some weird-ass jewelry, man. It was like trilobites, like cut-out stones of trilobites and fish fossils and, like, you know, claws of saber-tooths or whatever it was. And it would be on this rock. And the rock would be like this big.
Rock. You needed to cool yourself off
cool
there.
Cool it down, man. Now, the rock was like this big. The rock was like this big. Might as well pour it all out, shit. The rock was like this big, and then there would be a big old chain that hung down. And then we would sell those. And
door to door, right?
We would sell them door to door.
That, yeah. To me, is just like, that is commitment.
Yeah. Well, we used to sell them on Sunset Boulevard. So,
of course.
We were moved around a lot. We moved from Koreatown, West Hollywood, then we went to West L.A., came back up to West Hollywood. And then by the time we had the jewelry, they were doing a lot of stuff at home and out of a workshop. And then they would pack it up. It was crazy. And then they would pack it up. And then they would go door to door from about Crescent Heights to where, like, the Soho Club is right now, where that area, Boa Steakhouse, that area. So they would take that whole stretch of Sunset Boulevard, and they would go door to door to each store and ask them if they wanted to sell this jewelry or buy it, you know. And then they would go up and down La Cienega, too.
So, you know, it's like when you have working parents and there's no money for a full-time nanny, children absorb all this stuff in the grown-up world. And it's fascinating to me how Roy negotiated his way through this period when he was basically a latchkey kid. And I just think it's a great time for him to read a little bit so you get some flavor of the book.
Yeah, I was a latchkey kid at this time, as she mentioned. It was a weird time in Los Angeles. You know, my parents were working, trying to hustle, make their money. But they left me alone. But it's not really that they left me alone, but the city was there for the taking. It's like I was riding buses at 5. And I think back now, like, what the fuck was this bus driver thinking? You know, like, he let me on the bus, you know, and I had nobody with me except myself. And I don't know, it was just a weird time in L.A., you know. It was the hippie era of L.A. Okay, so I'll read from here. It's a couple pages, so just bear with us. All right. With the family business closed, we moved and moved again and again as my parents hustled all over town, working at their friends' gas stations, wig shops, video stores. We bounced around South Central and back up through Crenshaw before finally ending up in West Hollywood in a rent-controlled property that my uncle managed. We were on the second story surrounded by single mothers and hippies in a duplex filled with moving boxes torn open as needed. My parents tried to dig up a new life in the jewelry business. They went straight to the source, taking dusty field trips out to the local mines to check out the turquoise, fossils, agate, and big mineral pendants that matched the huge sunglasses, long linen dresses, and bell bottoms that were so popular in the mid-70s. My dad even studied up at the Gemological Institute of America and became a certified gemologist. Together, he and my mom would peddle their wares door to door from our neighborhood all the way up to the fancy boutiques on Sunset Boulevard. It's hard to make a sale with a kid on your back, so my parents left me behind. For 2 years until I was about 7, I had a key around my neck, but no lock on my life. So I wandered. I walked until I put holes in my soles. And the more hours they clocked, the longer I was alone, ready to be adopted by the city streets. I discovered the urban forest of old palms and sycamores right below Olympic Boulevard. Made my way into alleyways and onto their broken sidewalks. Got lost in the dull lights of the 7-Eleven and swiped candy, chips, beef jerky. Why not? I hopped on and off buses, getting off in Koreatown, where I discovered tamales and sniffed out kimchis, some in jars, others in plastic bags. I found hot dogs and carne asada being grilled at the park, studied the jars of soybean paste stocked in the market aisles. I rode my way down to Little Tokyo and tasted fish-shaped pastries filled with red beans. Grabbed aluminum foils filled with savory pancakes. I saw kids, but most of them weren't Korean or any other type of Asian. Mostly were black or white instead. I wondered why I wasn't them. I always managed to get back home before my parents did. When they did finally turn the key in the lock, it was like spinning the wheel of fortune. Sometimes my parents would grab me for a grand trip, like to Oxnard for vegetables. Other times, we'd just go to the market for a carton of Marlboro Reds and a handle of Cutty Sark. Or maybe we wouldn't do either, and they'd just go straight to the bottle and yell and sometimes smack me to blow off some steam. Then they'd tell me what a great son I was and cook up a grand feast. I never knew what was coming until it was already done. Whatever we did, our nights usually ended with their friends dropping in and empty bottles and red cigarette boxes littering the coffee table. Food, booze, smoke, and chatter. Just a little weeknight together. Nothing wrong with that, right? Truth is, I didn't know what was right or wrong. The English-only rule was supposed to turn me into an American. But that alone didn't spell out how to actually be American. I still ate kimchi and porridge, but got a beatdown if I spoke Korean. So fuck, I didn't even know how to be Korean either. Everything was a jumble. So what does a bewildered, lonely boy who can't find the right words do? Throw up the bat signal, of course. Get some outside help. And the Fonz, my great American superhero, answered the call. He swooped in with his Fonzie touch, his thumb of approval, and gave me some confidence. This being the city where dreams are made, it just so happened that my neighbor's mom worked at Paramount Studios, where Happy Days was being filmed. She got us special passes to meet him. I was so fucking excited. On that great day, we went through the famous gates, walked onto Paramount's famous studio lot. The Fonz was busy when we found him. I know my friend and I were probably the least important things on Henry Winkler's agenda that day. But he was the Fonz, man. Can you read the rest?
Yeah, let me just...
No. That rest part is really good.
Yeah, I know, but I want you to tell it to me.
Well, okay, I'll read it.
No,
I'm ready now. I'm ready. I just needed a moment. Classy above all, a drink of water for a park soul. He stopped what he had been doing and did all the niceties for us. But beyond that, he looked at me and said something without words. He somehow told me that shit would get deep, but to hang in there, because I had an interesting road ahead. And he gave me the thumbs up. Fuck, the Fonz read my palm when all I was looking for was his thumb. And that was it. Whatever my parents were going to do that night suddenly didn't matter. Something inside me unjumbled and fell into place, like a code had been cracked. I looked at that thumb, and a deep part of me saw the flavors in our fingertips, on a level I wasn't even aware of. I was encouraged to make that a part of my life. Touch of gold, everything's better, so much. So much means flavor in the fingertips.
So incredible. One of the reasons why I love that passage so much, aside from the fact that it's incredibly evocative, is I just really believe that people who are great with flavor, people who end up being really great chefs and communicating through food, are at the core voyeurs who travel through life and just absorb things like a sponge. Not just actual sense of food, but all sense of what's out there. So you're a kid, you start going to school, so you're in the American plan when you're at school.
Yeah.
And what was that like for you, elementary school? Where were you? Where were you going to elementary school, junior high?
I bounced around three elementaries, Hobart, also Rosewood, and then back to one, I don't remember the name. And then and I moved to Orange County in seventh grade, but elementary school was just a blur. You know, it was just a blur. I wrote about it, but I don't remember like specific moments because I was a latchkey kid. I was kind of alone, and everything kind of just blended together.
I
moved a lot, but the thing was, I did notice a lot that, you know, the food that I was eating was different. So that was something that I started to notice.
And I
noticed
over?
The parental structure a lot too, you know, especially with a lot of the friends that I was with, you know, like especially bouncing around, especially by the time I got down to Anaheim and things like that, just being around friends who had parents, you know, like our house was extremely, you know, like structured and intense and, you know, study based, but then also really erratic with the drinking and stuff. But, you know, a lot of my friends' houses, you know, like, They were kicking it with their parents, you know, like your parents, just kicking it, like smoking in front of them, and like, you know.
And what about the refrigerators when you opened them up?
Yeah, that was more like in junior high and high school. Like I moved to Orange County in junior high, and I moved to a pretty affluent neighborhood. You know, my parents got into jewelry a second time. We had a restaurant in between. The restaurant went under, and then they got back into jewelry, but this time, it was a different situation because it was Reaganomics, and a lot of people were getting rich, and especially the Korean community was getting rich, and a lot of people were moving in. And my mom, every situation, my mom applied her hustle, and this was another hustle. At first, it was the kimchi, and then she would sell it door-to-door, and then the restaurant and all these things, and then the agate jewelry. But this one was a really deep hustle where she looked for trophy wives, you know, and she looked for the whales, and then she would get D-flawless stones and emeralds and South Sea pearls, and then her angle was like she would cut them and really make them really beautiful and take them to parties, you know, like gatherings. And she'd be like, Tiffany upcharges 60%. I upcharge 10%. What are you going to do? What are you going to do with it? And then so they started rolling, man. And then a product was great, just like her kimchi. And, you know, we became rich. So we moved to Orange County, town called Villa Park, which is next to Orange. And I had never experienced anything like it before in my life, you know.
Tell me about the house.
The house was Nolan Ryan's old house. So, but I didn't know. And the moment I found out, I write about it in the book, but the way I found out was pretty hilarious. You know, like my dad didn't even tell us we were moving. Like, that's like how my dad is. You know, like Asian men are very stoic, you know, like they don't say nothing to you. And then when they do say something to you, it's usually like, let's go, you know. And then, and so, like, he said that. He's like, let's go. And then, like, he really meant let's go. We were like moving. And so we move, and then, you know, we're driving down from, you know, going down to Orange County, and then we ended up in this town, and it's beautiful. It's Villa Park is like this unincorporated town. It has no stoplights. It has no lights in the whole city, and mansions everywhere. And then we pull into this house, this corner white house with the picket fence and everything, and walks us in, realizes it's our house, and he walks me straight to the bathroom, puts his foot on the toilet, and he flushes the toilet. And he goes, you know what? You know whose house this was? You know who took a shit right here? I'm like, no. And then he's like, Nolan Ryan. And I'm like, Nolan Ryan. And then so like, yeah. So that all I could imagine was Nolan Ryan taking a shit on this, my whole high school life, all I could imagine is like me sitting on the same toilet as Nolan Ryan. So every time I'd watch him on TV, I'd be like, I know what's up. You know, but, yeah, we moved into his house, and the neighborhood, you know, was all Caucasian, was all white. And so they had never seen food like we eat before. And
talk a little about the food and your mom.
Fermenting. Oh, my mom was just cooking relentlessly, 4:30 a.m., just up. You know, like, I never woke up to, like, a bowl of cereal, you know. Like, I woke up to, like, stews and like, 16 different vegetables and like braises and broiled fish, and you know, going through puberty and all that, all the high school stuff, and so it was a little bit of a social scar, because you bring friends over and our house didn't smell like potpourri. You know, like you open the door and it was like an accordion of dead fish, you know, like all over, you know, hanging, and on the floor, just empty buckets and bottles of paste and fish and guts. And then, you know, any Asians in here will understand. You open the refrigerator, and the refrigerators are lined with newspaper because everything spills inside, you know, and it's dirty and, like, stinky. And so, like, everything is, like, triple layered with newspaper. And then there's nothing recognizable in the fucking refrigerator. You open the refrigerator.
No Lunchables.
There's no Lunchables. There's no sodas. And there's no string cheese. There's no. There's nothing. There's no Smuckers. There's no nothing. And they're just like these unmarked jars of fermenting paste. And when you're 16, you're like, oh, you know. So. Yeah.
But did she put your friends down at the table and feed them?
Yeah, she did. You know, they liked the food, but you know, they made comments, you know.
And when you went to their house, what was it like when you opened their refrigerator? Like,
oh, man, it was like walking into Ralph's or walking, you know. Yeah, you know, like I describe it here in the book, like, you know, Indonesian teak wood, you know, refrigerators. You open it up, the whole wall opens up, and then you know, like, I write, they had fruit platters and brie cheese. It's like, who the fuck has fruit platters and brie cheese in the refrigerator just because? You know, and you open it up, and there's fruit platters and brie cheese, and there's, like, TV dinners, and there's so many that they're stacked up like library books, and just everything you want. Oreo cookies, flaky flicks, Nilla wafers, softbatch,
so you were an equal opportunity, you know, eater.
Yeah, it was like it was my chance to like to dive in all the way, you know, because those things were, you know, our experiences with American food was on a different angle, you know, like it's not like we were completely unaware of it or blocked off from it, but we just buy weird stuff, you know, like Dinty Moore beef stew in the can and corned beef hash in the can and like Spam and like Vienna sausages. That was like what we buy.
And if you went out to dinner at a restaurant, an American restaurant, where would you go?
Where'd we go? We go Bob's Big Boy and Tommy's, you know. My parents, like, again, like, you have to understand, like, as immigrants, we didn't have, like, the dummy book of how to be American, you know. Like, there's no, like, manual of, like, how to do this. So there was no curfews or anything. And so, like, I think about it now, though, it's kind of weird because they left me alone during the day, but they took me at night to our movies. You know, it should have been kind of reversed. Like, they should have kept me with them and then left me alone to study at home. But, you know, I saw Midnight Express, Apocalypse Now, all kinds of weird movies. Like, and then what we would do is, after the movie, we'd go to Bob's Big Boy and eat chili spaghetti. So I really loved that.
You love sauces.
I love sauces and gloopy stuff. I love Tommy's after Dodger games and sauces. I was a sauce packet fiend, and I'm very anal with my sauces. I love sauces. I surround myself with bottles and things like that.
So through high school, were you a good student?
No, not really. I was good until sixth grade. I was on that path to be a pretty good student. I did well. They used to do like IQ tests and stuff like that, you know, and every Asian parent puts their kid through that torture. I was a good student up until junior high. Then I started smoking weed. You know.
So then we enter the interesting period. The interesting period of, you had such a diversely interesting life. So let's talk about nightlife and
sure.
K-Town clubs and...
Very similar to this.
and Hollywood Boulevard and... Was this the period of time that you were lowriding?
No, lowriding was in high school. I was... I worked hard throughout high school and back then... In the late 80s, mini trucks were big, you know, and with hydraulics and lifted beds and everything. And then the old classics with Daytons and Regals and Impalas and everything. And even though I had moved to Orange Villa Park, I still had a lot of connections to L.A. and also to Anaheim and Fullerton. And so, you know, a lot of people, when they look at O.C., they think it's only one thing. But OC is actually a really deep county. You know, there's a lot of going on, especially in North Orange County. And so I was with the crew, and one of my friends, Robert Torres, he had family and cousins in Norwalk that ran a crew called Street City Minis. And I had just bought a Blazer, and I dropped it all the way. And this was the cleanest ride. You know, it was a white Blazer, dropped all the way. It was about this high off the ground. And with some deep dish inkies and just clean as could be. And
what does that mean in English?
rims, deep dish chrome rims with 50 series tires. You cut the leaf springs out of the back so that it sits all the way down on the ground. And you just cruise through the city. And the ride was fresh, you know. And so... he brought me down to Norwalk. We drove down there, and I became part of this crew. So, started cruising Whittier Boulevard through Pico Rivera. That was all through like 87, 88, 89, and I ended that chapter saying that was Papi Chulo in the making. You know, like I was cruising, and those were some good times. Man, we used to pop our window back up. You know, everyone was hanging out. You know, it was the day of Aquanet with the pompadour and everything. And everyone just jumping in and out of the cars, having fun. You know, every dude had hickeys on their neck except me. You know, like, like, man, the cholas did not want to be with me, you know. So, like, but I was cool. You know, I was just driving. That was that time. And then I was in college, kind of like after high school and stuff. In college, I got into, started hanging out in K-Town again. And going to the clubs. You know, K-Town clubs were crazy back then. Like, they're still crazy right now, but the 90s K-Town club life was just absolutely out of control.
What does that mean? Given that now they seem kind of out of control now.
Yeah.
So how?
You know, bottle service, booking, bringing girls over, just crazy. The town, you know, like the town, and K-Town was kind of like ours, you know, completely ours. Like, it wasn't this mecca of food, you know, curiosity, you know, that it is now. You know, like, it was, like, nobody was coming to Koreatown except us, you know. And so it was like having your own Sim City, you know, like, it was just ours. And so, like, we would just go in and out, clubs, bars, eat at Hodorichip, Nagwangchip on Vermont, go to San on A Street and Mom's Place, and, you know, get porridge and soups and stews till 3-4 a.m. And so, you know, just be spending a lot of money. I was gambling during that time. So I was raking in.
You were lucky for a really long time.
I was lucky for about a year and a half, yeah, almost 2 years, raking in a lot of money at Commerce and Bicycle Club, spending that money at the club, and then going out to eat in restaurants. And it was a great, great time in L.A.
Until you started the slide, until you started losing.
Yeah, you know, gambling is the deepest vice that we write about in the book. And, you know, gambling is a crazy addiction because it will make you sell everything in your body and in your life. If you don't get out of it, the difference between gambling and drugs is drugs, you can destroy yourself. With gambling, you destroy everything around you. And then once it pulls you into the sinkhole, it's really rare for you to get out of it. You know, so what you see is a lot of gamblers that start on the high end and a really amazing ride, and then you'll see them again many years later in the same casino, and they've completely become hollowed out. And, you know, much respect to them, man. You know, they're sitting there right now at Commerce and Bicycle right now. You know, lives completely torn apart, families torn apart, businesses sold, you know, pink slips and mortgages put on the table.
So
completely lost.
How did that not happen to you? What happened?
Emerald. You know, I got lucky. It's Emerald, and I had a family structure, you know. But a lot of guys that get lost there, they give up on their family, or their family gives up on them. And the underlying theme of this book is, no matter what I did, my parents never gave up on me. Even though they weren't the perfect parents, but they never gave up. But I was lying on the couch, and I was watching TV, and it was 95 or 96, and I was out of money, owed people money, getting in fights every night, drunk. I was a thorn in everyone's side. I only had a couple friends left that allowed me to kick it still on the couch. And my friend Yogi, he was, you know, I was at his crib, and, you know, I was on the couch in the morning, and the show came on, and I felt like he was talking to me.
Emerald.
Yeah. I felt like I had an out-of-body experience, I guess.
It was one of those moments where everything narrows down. And it's just you and him.
I remember like 15, 20, we used to talk about out-of-body experiences a lot, right? I was big in literature, right? Yeah, but we don't talk about it much anymore. But I had one of those. And he narrowed down, he came out at me, and he was talking to me. And then I woke up, and he was back in the TV. But something crystallized for me. And I woke up, and I knew what I had to do.
And so this path, this culinary path, mm-hmm. had it ever been consciously lurking there before?
I don't think professionally, but I was around food my whole life. You know, I was born into a food family. We had thousands of years of history and folklore and lineage as people that were food, you know, providers. It's different in Asia than some of the stories. You know, our country here in America is only a few hundred years old, right? But you're talking about civilizations that are 4,000 years old, you know, so they got all kinds of stories they make up, you know, like, you know, who knows if any of them are true, but they believe them, and, you know, they have these lineages and these folklore stories. Some people are warriors, some people are poets and scholars, and, you know, my family, they were cooks. And so I was around it. I was always around food my whole life. We lived in a restaurant. We had a restaurant for 3 years. Extended family, stores, restaurants, hamburger shops. Worked all throughout high school as a busboy and a teppanyaki grill cleaner and a prep cook. But I never thought I was going to be a chef. You know, it wasn't a profession to even comprehend, you know.
So you make this decision.
Yeah.
Emeril talks to you, and you make the decision that you're going to go to the CIA.
Yeah, well, my mom convinced me to go to CIA because I was going to go to the CCA, which is in San Francisco. Uh-huh. And I was fucking with this girl up in the Bay. And I was like, yo, I'm gonna go CCA. I'm going to kick it with her. I'll be closer, and, like, it'll be cool. And I'll get my studying done. But my mom, like, she was like, nah. Like, if you're going to go and do this, this is your last, this is the last ticket I got for you, bro. And, like, if you're going to do this, you're going to go to CIA in New York. You know, and I looked at the brochure and I was like, oh my goodness. It's in the middle of the Hudson River, 2 hours north of the city, in the sticks. And, you know, I was 26 years old, you know, still full of adrenaline. And I was like, I'm not going here, man. But
what,
I went.
What was that like when you first, we have a picture actually that I love for its absolute adorableness.
That's the young me right there.
But this is the you so like in a groove. I mean, the CIA is.
Yeah, that's graduation. So I had gone through the program. So I was.
The program.
I was rebuilt as a human and as a person.
You so know, like I, military school in a way.
Yeah, I was fresh. I was new. I had gathered some knowledge, and I had been refreshed. You know, like charging your phone. Man. That's after charging your phone right there. Yeah.
I can't believe how fast the time has gone.
It was a wonderful place, though. It's like we just came from there on the tour. It's like Hogwarts, man. It's so crazy. You know, it's secluded on the banks of the Hudson River in this old Jesuit seminary, and there's like everyone there is dressed the same, and they're all feel like they're 14, and they're all like eager and like feel like they all have this own magic power to cook, you know, and they're all carrying like their things, which are like wands, but they're knives, and they're all going around and just moving around. It's a pretty magical place.
And you had this really amazing magical moment after, because at part of graduating the CIA is finding an externship.
Oh yeah.
You had a really hard time settling into. To find one, and you were kind of panicking.
Yeah, I was panicking, and externship is like the most important thing to a culinary student. And all my friends, it's like getting your externship at CIA is like one of those things you needle your friend and make them feel bad if you got a better one. You know, that's what it is. And so as soon as each friend was getting one, you know, of course they would let you know, and they wouldn't let you know just once, but they let you know until they decided they didn't want to let you know anymore. And then, and so you're talking about restaurants like Danielle, Gotham Bar and Grill, Oriole, Le Grenouille Tavern on the Green, you know.
The creme de la creme.
The creme de la creme, you know, and then I couldn't get one, you know, and I was going around, I was stashing at a bunch of different places, and I was walking down 51st Street with my head down, and I was kind of dejected, and I had one last resume up, and I don't know, I've had these magical moments in my life. You can believe them or you can not believe them, but, you know, I was a part of the Kogi truck, so you better believe this shit, you know? You know, like, so I have these magical moments, and then, like, I look up, and then there's this dude in the window. It's Eric Repair, right, from La Bernardin, but I look up, it's like four, like, right before service. And I had no idea who he was, but I felt like I knew him, you know. And then I had this resume, and I held it up like this. And I'm like this, and he said, "Come in." I was like, "Okay." And then he made these gestures, and I went around, went up, and I ended up in the kitchen, and there he was. And I realized it was him. And I think back now how amazing of a man he was to do this, because I was just some dude walking down 51st Street, and he was looking out the window. He gestured for me to come in, And it was right before service, around 5 o'clock. And if any of you cooking as a profession, you know what that time of the day feels like and how important it is. He brought me in the office, talked to me for 15 minutes about La Bernardin and everything that it is and the history of it. Took me to the pass. It's a French system, so there's no tickets. All the orders are called in, and then you have to bring the food from each station. So I stood at the pass. You bring it to the chef. Stood there. They brought me water. I stood there for like an hour watching service. Then he was keeping his eye on me, brought me back into the office, and asked me how I felt about it. And he gave up about 2 hours and 15 minutes of his time for me, and then offered me an externship. And then I ended up staying on a little while longer. He was nice again to allow us to go through the kitchen and take pictures as well. So we captured some really great pictures of Eric, Chris Mueller, who's the chef de cuisine, and Coco, who is the sous chef.
So what fascinates me is there's that whole story, which is just like a gift from God.
Yeah.
And then you graduate, and then you start working, and the thing that most of us hear about when we hear about chefs is we hear about standalone restaurants, you know, very individual vision standalone restaurants. But that's not where the majority of chefs are working. A lot of chefs work in the hotel industry.
Oh, yeah.
And you started carving out a career in the hotel industry, and you ended up in this private club.
Yeah, I've cooked in so many different environments. I mean, this book is an homage to a lot of hotel chefs. You know, it's an homage to people who've been through addictions, immigrants, hotel chefs, outcasts, you know, those of you that maybe don't fit in all the way to certain things. But, hotel chefs always get overlooked and get the short end of the stick, but it's such an amazing journey to be a hotel chef, because you have to cook for people when... In moments that aren't the most romantic, you know? So, like, we have to cook for you during a meeting. We have to cook for you when you're grumpy and when you wake up. We have to cook for you when you're going to sleep, you know? And, you never get credit for it, and you never get acknowledged for it. So you have, as a chef or as a cook, you have to find your own motivation to make that food great. And for me, I honed in on just making the situation and the moment great. So I started to cut my sandbags of all my classmates were getting glory. They were becoming chef de cuisines and getting written. Back then we didn't have food blogs and stuff like that. So we had only one source, which was Food Arts magazine. And so we would always open up the Food Arts and look for the section called Deep Dish and figure out like who's where and things like that. But, you know, a lot of my friends were coming up, I came to terms with the fact that I'm not going to get in Bon Appetit or Gourmet or anything like that, you know. So then I switched my energies and just focused on the moment and cooking for you, in breakfast and trying to make it the best eggs that I could. Or if it was your wedding or your anniversary, just really, really caring and considering yourself. And then when I was a chef at a country club, my clientele, it was a retiree country club in Borrego Springs. And every guest was, the minimum age was 65 to get into this club, you know. So like, it was like 65 to 90, you know. And like our dinner rush was 5:15. Our dinner rush was 5. We were done and clean by 7 o'clock. But I learned so much. I learned so much because they had enough, all the time in the world to tell me their stories, where they came from, what they ate. And so I relearned American food classics, and I learned how to cook and care about any person and any individual in any moment. So I think all of those, looking back, helped me to be able to cook for the streets, you know, to understand different appetites, understand... how to care when no one's caring or no one's looking, you know, so.
I think it's time to take some questions.
Okay. You gotta wait for the mic.
We have to wait for the...
They got rules in the library. You cannot break the rules of the library.
I don't think that you were there in 94 in Borrego Springs, were you?
94 Borrego Springs? No, that was a little too early for me. I was in Borrego from late 98, like New Year's Eve 98, till like 2001.
You didn't know La Casa del Zorro?
I was the chef at La Casa del Zorro.
Well, there you are. I lived in Borrego Springs after the earthquake.
Oh, okay.
My house was destroyed. Yeah. So I moved there and stayed there for a year and a bit in the resort. And I loved it.
So you know how beautiful it is. Yes. Borrego Springs is just
east. And I ate at the Casa.
Yeah, Borrego Springs is just east of the Salton Sea in the northern San Diego Desert. So it's at the bottom tip of Coachella Valley. And the La Casa del Zorro Resort is an old resort, cabanas and old adobe cabanas. And it was like this four-star resort. I got recruited out of culinary school to go there. And it was amazing. It was an amazing time. I learned how to become a manager there. You know.
Question over here.
Yes.
You know, Roy, so you talk about your time as a hotel chef. I think back at when I used to DJ a lot in restaurants, and how people usually don't even talk to you unless there's something wrong, you know.
Yeah.
And so in so many different environments that you know you perform in, could you share with us maybe like, you know, an anecdote of a situation you were in where you kind of had some sort of a insight into, you know, a different culture? I know you mentioned a little bit about
that. Oh, yeah, yeah. Working in the country club in Borrego, the clientele 65 and older, they would bring me clip outs of Sunset Magazine and cornucopia salads and old meatloaf recipes and stuff from Joy of Cooking, and they would watch me cook this stuff, and I had this like kind of insular family of grandmas that would help me cook, you know, and then we would cook from old clip outs and you know, before the computer age, you know, everyone kept their recipes on cards and stuff, right? So just having that ability to tap in and be connected to American culture on that level was really big for me, you know. So, and just having them there and them trusting, I mean, I don't even know what they were thinking, you know, like, because I'm just this, like, 28, 9-year-old Korean kid, you know, and but they were, like, unfolding all of their lineage and ancestry to me, you know, so that was cool.
You had a crazy, crazy experience out there, though. You had the goat.
The goat.
Could you tell the goat?
Yeah, I killed the goat but it was an amazing experience because in Borrego, even though it's a retirement community, just like in every town, you know, everyone working in the restaurants were all from Mexico, you know, so I was really close with everyone in town, and was close to my dishwasher. His name was Salvador, and he had a restaurant in Mexicali, and he picked me up. He asked me when we were working one day, he asked me one question. He goes, "Can you help me out?" And si puede ayudar, ayúdame. And then I was like, "Okay, sure." I'm kind of dude, I don't even need to know why. If you ask me something, I'll just do it. And so he picked me up the next morning, and we drove out to Coachella, and I saw this sign that said Chivo, and we picked up this goat. And I still had no idea what we were going to do, and we brought him back. And we went to his house. He let the goat go. He had a whole table. I started to put the pieces together. He had knives out. And then, but then before I even could put it together, he looked at me straight in the eye, and he goes, "Listo?" I go, "Listo?" And then he jumped on this goat, and then he just ran at it and got in a headlock. We killed it and stripped it, broke it down, put it in igloos, and then went to Mexicali, and then we started to cook birria. It was great. Yeah.
What an amazing, that's just like a gem.
Yeah, it was really amazing. Wherever Salvador is right now, man, much love to him. Yeah. Hey, Barbara.
Hi, Barbara.
Yes, I have a comment before my question. You did make it into Bon Appetit.
Oh.
tell us a little bit about your new restaurant.
Oh. New restaurant is called Pot. I'll shift my energies towards that once this whole fiasco with the book is over, you know. it's in Koreatown, you know. So coming back home, it's in a hotel on Wilshire in Normandy, which was the old Radisson. And it's a big cement post-modern building built in the 60s. And the restaurant's called Pot, you know, like... And so,
Like the smoke or the cooking vessel?
No, it's the cooking vessel. But what I think it is, but you know, it's just going to naturally imply, you know, weed, you know, because like people are going to say, let's go get some pot, you know, and then they're going to be talking about restaurants, you know. So, but it's really a restaurant, I think, to reimagine Silver Garden, which was my family restaurant, and we had a hot pot at Silver Garden that was like our signature dish, and I want to kind of try to reinvent that. And it's Korean food in Koreatown. I think it's a pretty ambitious restaurant. It's one of those restaurants that if it does well, you guys are all going to love it, and if it doesn't, I'm going to fall flat on my face. And that's kind of how I approach this book and how I'm approaching this restaurant. So it's a Korean restaurant in Koreatown, run by a Korean-American kid who was never trained in Korean food. So we'll see what happens. Yes?
How did you come up with the concept of a seeming fusion of Korean and Mexican food that you serve on your trucks?
Yeah, sure. Kogi came from an idea from my partner. We used to work together at the Beverly Hilton, and then I worked at another job after that. And then I had gotten laid off, and I was out of work. But Mark and I really never hung out, so it was kind of weird. Like, we were just work friends, really. And we never hung out outside of work. He never called me. But somehow he knew I was out of a job for a few months, and he just called me out of the blue. And he was just, I mean, Mark's a pretty carefree dude. And he literally, if you can imagine, it's like a guy you never call, never talk to, never hang out with. Call you, what up, dog? I heard you lost your job. Fuck that shit. Let's go open a truck. I was like, all right, you know. he had this idea to put Korean barbecue in a taco and park outside the nightclubs. And there was a club back then called Cabana and Green Door in Hollywood. And so he gave me that. I gelled on it, and then it just opened up a levee within me. I just started cooking and started kind of directing the culture of what we were going to do, and then brought in his wife and his sister-in-law, and they filled in roles, and then we went out at the club, and then once we made the taco, and it started to become everything LA Sun is. It started to become everything I just talked to you about, my life here in Los Angeles, and I found the way to make that flavor. We went out in front of the club, and then from there, the whole diagram was on the fly. You know, everything that happened and that you see, there was no playbook again, and everything that happened, all the routes, all the stops, all the way that we communicated the culture, the food, the style, the systems, they all happened right there on the streets, on the fly, you know. It was really great.
Question over here.
Yes.
What was the story behind or the motivation behind writing the book, which is quite a departure from all the restaurants that you've been working on?
Sure. Just telling you, this is like my bar mitzvah. This is my coming out party. It was time for me to grow up, you know, and I couldn't grow up any further until I confronted some things in my past, you know. So, but people, Kogi was a phenomenon, you know. Like, it really struck a nerve in the consciousness of this world, you know. It took something that was considered dirty, and it took something that was considered foreign to a lot of society, and put it in their backyard, you know, and made it something that you wanted to be a part of. And so it continued to create this infective wave of interest, and people kept coming, basically, to ask me to write the Kogi book. But Kogi is a co-op. It's a collective of 6-7 people, and we're like a band. So I'm not the only voice of Kogi. So I kept denying it. Plus, I wasn't in the stage to write it. And then the requests were coming to myself personally, you know, write a book. And then I was hearing questions a lot of, not only from journalists, but from people on the street, people that we were feeding. Like, how did you come up with this flavor? You know, I know it's really hard to comprehend. It's still very weird for me, but, you know, just getting stopped on the street and saying, how did you come up with this flavor? This changed my life, you know. Explain this to me right now. And this is people I never met in my life, you know, telling me this, and this happening 5-6 times a day, every day. So I kept trying to avoid it, but then I woke up just like with Emeril. I woke up one day and said, you know what, it's time. I'm ready. I think that's why the book came about. I looked in the mirror and I said, I'm ready. So then I called my friends, Natasha and Tin, told them I was ready. We came up. And once I said I was ready, we had the whole book on. We wrote the outline of the book at Lucy's on Pico and Union, and I had the whole book already there. It was already mapped out, and we just had to fill in the blanks.
And I just want to say that the Not a Fiasco is now like number 19 on New York Times bestseller list. Thank you. With a bullet. Yeah.
Did you get a chance to meet Henry Winkler a second time?
No, I haven't. This is LA. Any of y'all know
it's
Henry
happen.
Winkler?
You're going to have to. You have to cook for him.
I think he's on Twitter. I got to hit him up, right? I think he's really. I'm going to hit him up on Twitter. You guys all hit him up. We'll all hit him up at the same time. All right? Anyone here on Twitter, let's hit up Henry Winkler, and I would love to meet him. He writes children's books. He changed my life.
I think it needs to be a meal with you, Emeril, and the Fonz. I'll be a dishwasher.
That would be awesome, you know. If only Pat Morita was still around, you know. R.I.P. to Pat, man, you know. But yeah, we could do that, you know. Yes.
I'm just curious, when you're not cooking or creating recipes or thinking about food or opening restaurants, are there other things you like to do?
I don't have any hobbies. I wish I did. I really wish I had like a hobby, you know. But I don't. I smoke weed.
Oh, that works.
You have a wife and a child.
Yeah.
You have family. He has family life.
But yeah, in my free time, I smoke weed.
I love that. That's your hobby.
That's wild. It really is. I actually have to put weed on my calendar now, because I have all those things I have to take care of. Yeah, I actually have a responsible life that I have to actually show up for every day. And so, I, you know, everything has a calendar, so I have to put weed on my calendar so that it doesn't transcend into something I have to do. Like, I couldn't come up here stoned. It would be disrespecting you. So, like, you know, I couldn't. I have to map it out between.
Do you plan on branching out, opening restaurants outside of Los Angeles, East Coast, or Vegas?
Yeah, well, I think this book is a part of that process, you know, of growing up. You know, Kogi happened on a whim. You know, we didn't know this was all going to happen. We just went out there serving. Then the lines got longer. Everything started changing, started becoming intense. We never caught our footing, you know, so we don't even have a business plan still, you know, and so we never recouped and got back to things. So we just kept it going. It's this amazing, like plant that just keeps growing, and we'd never trim it, you know. And so, but this book was a process, and I feel like next year, 2014, is a year for me to finally to figure that out. Because not just for the business side, but I feel like this flavor that we cook, especially with Kogi, I would love to see it in college towns, and I would love to see it in other places, just because of what it does to people, you know. Any of you that have Kogi, have had Kogi, or support us or represent us, you know what I'm talking about. It changes the disposition in people, and it makes us open up to each other and care about each other for a second, you know. So I would love to bring that around the world. You know what I mean?
The last time I saw Roy, I was gifted with a little take-home package for my 93-year-old mother. And so I get home, and I hand it to her, and she takes a bite out of it. She says, "What the fuck is this?" She became a part of the club, like, right away.
That sounds like Kogi.
Yeah.
Yes. Two more.
Okay. Two more? Okay.
You brought up how the food trucks at the time were considered dirty. You know, and I think at the time even the state or the city was like, there's a legislator trying to bring the food trucks down.
Yeah.
Because of the, you know, brick and mortar established restaurants. What were some of the obstacles you ran into, like getting the truck up and running and, you know, where it's at now?
You know, I think it was just honesty and being true to the culture of the Latino culture here in Los Angeles and the taco culture, but also being a little ignorant as well and not caring about any of that stuff and just going out there and doing it. Because we didn't believe any of those fallacies or those lies, and they were our friends and family members. You know, I got the nickname Poppy from the Loncheras, the ladies running the Loncheras. You know, like, we got respect as soon as we came in because we really respected the culture. But the main thing is, what I'm talking about is the fallacy that these things are dirty, is that what people don't realize is all of these trucks are licensed by the same city that, you know, they're creating these lies about, you know, that the city is creating lies about, you know. So, like, it's the same license that a restaurant has to go through, the same health permits, the same business license, and it's coded as well. And it's also within law that these trucks can exist and sell, and they only have a few restrictions. So everything outside of that is just, speculation and human, mixing up the rumors and mixing up their intentions. So, but our approach was to not be seen, you know. So that's why if you look at Kogi routes, we were out next to train tracks or behind industrial zones, or and we used the power of Twitter, you know. And so we didn't really run into any problems. You know?
But I also believe that Kogi and Roy were the crossover that made everything else possible.
Yeah.
Because being part of the LA Food Policy Council, one of our biggest initiatives was legalization, because in LA it's a problem of the whole health part of it is all permitted. It's a land use issue. So that also extends to the people who sell fruit, people who sell the hot dogs. And actually this week at City Council, finally brought it into the city council. So it's a huge thing that happened, and I think it only happened because you broke it open.
Wow, that's cool. And she understands that high-level politics stuff, like, but there's also street politics too, you know? So, like, even if every rule was laid out where you could do this, midnight on the streets, you still got to figure stuff out. So the lucky thing we had was that Kogi was good. It was delicious. And so, like, even people trying to bother us, or even police that would maybe tell us to move, we'd say, no, before you tell us to move, try this. And then they try the blackjack because they have the reaction that her mom had.
There you go.
And they'd be like, oh, what was I here for? You know. So we were very lucky. But I think through our luck, if we're talking about this stroke of God or spirituality or whatever, through our luck, created the pathway for things like this to happen. You know, we had to be that lucky one. You know. Last question.
Is your mother involved in any of the restaurants you own?
No, not currently. My mom and I can't cook together, man. We cannot be in the same. If there are six burners anywhere within the vicinity, we should not be within the same zone, because we're very, very type A personalities in the kitchen. So, like, if she's cooking, I just completely shut it off. I go to the farthest room possible, and I read a book or watch TV until she says dinner's ready. And if I'm cooking, she's not allowed anywhere within the zone. So we don't cook together.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.